This is part two of a three-part interview with Lieutenant William Driscoll, United States Navy. This interview is being conducted at the Naval Air Station Miramar, San Diego, California, on 15 March 1974. The interviewer is Captain R.A. Bowling, United States Navy, retired graduate student at San Diego State University.
Okay, well, could you go with your second MGKill now, please?
Certainly. The second MGKill occurred on the day of 8 May 1972. On this particular day, I was flying in an F-4J, and my mission was that as MGCAP. Now, a MGCAP aircraft is assigned to protect the main strike or bombing force. In our strike force, there are anywhere from 18 to 25 aircraft, each carrying from 6 to 15 500-pound bombs apiece. My job is to take up a station 10 to 12 miles north of the selected target area and maintain a racetrack-type pattern for several minutes while the strike group completes their assigned mission at the target area. Then, when we are assured that the strike group has completed their mission and has safely left the area and on their way home, we detach. My whole purpose of being here, of course, is to defend the strike group against the air-to-air related MiG threat. On the day of 8 May, I was on my inbound vector to my station when I received word from my controller that bandits, which is our slang term for MiGs, were airborne. I was given an attack heading, in which I promptly turned to and started my hot vector. Neither I nor my wingman was able to visually or on radar acquire the enemy aircraft. We continued with our hot vector, and again, our feeling was that we were starting to drift off from the area of our assigned mission. Therefore, we started a turn back to the left or to the south, and at that time, I happened to notice as I was scanning the horizon, a MiG-17 who had just popped through the clouds and appeared to be attacking us. I called this immediately to my pilot and to the other flight over the UHF radio. No one else was able to confirm a tally-ho, or that, of course, meaning yes, I have sight, or no tally-ho, of course, meaning no, I do not have sight. No one else confirmed or was able to come up with a tally-ho. Therefore, I maneuvered our flight, again telling my pilot where the MiG was coming from and where he would probably go. He called tally-ho, and he called our wingman to straighten the MiG out, and again, in terminology of aviators, this means the MiG is not a threat to you at this time, but let's keep him interested while I maneuver for a shot. Our wingman did this, and as he started to straighten the MiG out, and we started coming back to maneuver into a advantageous position for a shot, I saw two other MiG-17s pop through the clouds in an attacking position on us. My pilot directed our wingman to break off hard to the left, and he fired a heat-seeking missile which flew up the tailpipe of the MiG-17. However, at this time, we had two MiG-17s behind us shooting their gun. Just prior to my pilot shooting down this MiG-17 with our heat-seeker missile, we observed that MiG-17 shooting what appeared to be a heat-seeker missile of his own at my wingman. We, of course, just prior to our firing of our heat-seeker missile, instructed our wingman to break hard to the left that we're getting ready to shoot. He did this, we fired, shot down the MiG. The situation now is us and two MiG-17s behind us shooting. We're faced with a dilemma now of not being able to break either way, since we'd be breaking into the bullets are either on the two MiG aircraft. If, nonetheless, we elected to break to the left and discovered that the lower wing loading, higher maneuverability of the MiG-17, as we had heard in intelligence briefings, was certainly true, as he rendezvoused on the inside of our turn and still represented a serious offensive threat to our aircraft and certainly to ourselves. Therefore, realizing this and realizing that we still had an excellent chance of being shot down by the MiG aircraft if we continued in our present maneuver, realizing all these factors, we executed what is commonly called a MiG-17 disengagement maneuver. I, again, cannot talk about the specifics of the maneuver due to their classification level, but it is a maneuver based on some of the flight characteristics which we capitalize on against MiG-series aircraft. In other words, several of his weak points, knowing that he cannot duplicate the type of maneuver that we can do. Therefore, we do this maneuver. He cannot follow us through it, and it assists us in gaining some lateral separation between us and him and taking the first steps into getting away or escaping from that enemy aircraft. We started to do this, and at the same time, nonetheless, noticed that the MiG on either side was still back there pressing us quite severely. As we started to do this...
You had three MiGs on you now, didn't
you? Two MiGs. There were...
Two astern and this guy here on your wing.
This guy had been shot down. He'd been shot down by our heat-seeker missile. He'd been shot down a little bit early by our heat-seeker missile.
You got these two guys behind
us. Two guys behind us. There was a fourth MiG somewhere in the air that we'd never been able to sight visually, that we later learned was airborne in the general area at that time. What we had therefore elected to do to escape these two attacking MiGs on our tail was to put the nose down quickly and descend into the clouds. This entire fight took place at an altitude of perhaps 4,000 to 5,000 feet. However, there was a heavy cloud layer below. Therefore, we descended down into the clouds and saw both MiGs diving down behind us at our 6 o'clock position. We leveled out at perhaps 500 feet down below the cloud layer, accelerated, got our energy back up, although it was still at a good level, but accelerated, and then popped through the clouds, going right back up into the sun, realizing that the MiGs perhaps had a heat-seeker missile, and for us to go through the sun would certainly degrade their kill probability of this missile. We popped up again through the clouds, back up into the sun, talking to our wingman the whole time, who did not see us. He picked up tally-ho, or a aviation terminology which means I see you now. He picked up tally-ho when we popped back through the clouds, and we get back again into our original formation and continued our mission as MiGCAP, and again back out to the ocean and back to the carrier. 2 days later, 10 May 1972, we were again flying into the same general area, this time as flak suppressor. Now, a flak suppressor's main job is to let the main bombing force go into the target area and select their particular targets, make their runs, and we as flak suppressor will observe this, and when we sight anyone on the ground shooting a gun, a surface-to-air missile, and by gun I'm talking heavy anti-aircraft type gun, not just the conventional field weapon, but the heavy anti-aircraft artillery gun. When we spot this type of activity on the ground against the strike force, then we roll in on that particular threat, hence the name flak suppressor. That was our job. On this particular day, 10 May, we had flown into a railroad shipment point, Hai Dong Railroad Yard in North Vietnam, and we had made our flak suppression run after a relatively quiet or very passive attempt on the enemy's part to inhibit our Alpha strike. Again, this was rather surprising, since you can generally count on any type of flak from light to medium to heavy to extremely heavy. And this being a high threat area, we had planned on extremely heavy flak, and yet it was almost negligible. This surprised all of us. However, we were soon to find the reason for that. As we dropped our bombs, flak suppression bombs, I looked back over my shoulder to see exactly where they had hit. As I was looking back, I noticed 6 to 8 MiG-17 aircraft attacking our strike formation. And as I noticed this, I saw 5 to 6 other aircraft of MiG-related type, MiG-21, MiG-19, although I wasn't sure of the exact description, I did know they were the enemy aircraft several miles back in range. As we pulled off the target area, we get into a classic flailing aerial combat maneuvering battle. However, using MiGs, all adversary, of course, were jets, but it was the classic aerial combat maneuvering battle, which I am sure many of my predecessors in the World War I and World War II time frames have encountered on a similar nature.
Dogfight.
Dogfight is perhaps the most correct summation of what was to occur in the next 10 minutes. Now, the question of how has the fighter pilot's role in this arena changed in the past 50 years, and the answer to that question is probably little, if at all. There is still the same basic rules that must be followed. You must maintain the same basic types of lookout. You must be able to fly aggressively, and you must be able to successfully execute the same types of maneuvers. The difference, of course, comes in the degree of sophistication of the weapon systems, be they heat-seeker missiles, be they radar weapon systems, and, of course, in the degree of sophisticated aircraft that all people are flying, all aircraft being Mach 1 capable with rates of closure in excess of 2,000 miles per hour, this type of thing. Nonetheless, very simply, it's the man who sees the other first, it's the man who flies the most aggressive airplane, the man that sees his opponent make a mistake and capitalizes on that mistake, he is the man that is going to win.
Yeah. What would you say is the number one air fight tactical dictum? Get on his turn?
The number one tactical dictum is to possess an aggressive spirit. It cannot be taught. You must possess an aggressive spirit. You must temper that with a supreme element of confidence in your ability. Now, there are minor subtleties to that. We talk about mutual support and a wingman and a leader and the role changing back and forth just to support each other. Those are minor subtleties. In this particular arena, now, there are 6 Navy F-4 Phantoms against in the neighborhood of 18 to 20 MiG aircraft. And it's significant to note that on this particular day, and they're all from my squadron, we shot down 5 MiG aircraft and lost no airplanes to MiGs. We shot down 5. I, with Lieutenant Cunningham, shot down 3. A very close friend of mine shot down 2, and another good friend shot down 1. We lost no airplanes to MiG aircraft. Rather than give you a recounting of the exact maneuvering, we broke hard into one MiG number 1. He was not able to fly his airplane properly, overshot us. We reversed back and shot him down rather easily. MiG number 2, again, it was look out, pick somebody that you wanted to attack and attack him. Now, our feeling in the Navy fire community is that our opponents in this particular regime or environment, in most cases, were not good pilots. They were not trained very thoroughly, they were not overly aggressive, and they did not know how to fly their airplane in the air combat maneuvering arena. They made mistakes flying their airplane that a student in basic training would not make. They were not good or competent pilots. However, as we were leaving the area after shooting down 2 MiGs, we encountered a MiG-17 meeting us head-on Now, the battle that ensued with this MiG-17 pilot was without doubt the most thorough test of our nerves, our ability, our aggressiveness, and the abilities displayed by this North Vietnamese pilot were the most thorough, polished, professional, and outstanding of any pilot we've ever had the opportunity to fight against. We learned at a later time that this was their leading ace, Conrad Toom, who had, up until that time, shot down 13 American airplanes. When we engaged this particular MiG aircraft, he fired his, started firing his gun as we started passing head-on. We pitched up and made several maneuvers in the vertical plane, each of us trying to pull for the other man's 6 o'clock position. We in the F-4, however, did not have the gun. Therefore, we were not shooting at him during this time. We were striving for a missile envelope kill. He had the gun and was shooting at us repeatedly throughout these maneuverings, which at several different junctures during the maneuverings, we would have to knock it off, so to speak, or fly defensively rather than fly offensively and press the attack. Starting the termination of the third maneuver, when we were at a low point coming up and he was at a high point, he lost sight of our aircraft, rolled right, rolled left, did not see us, rolled down in an attempt to run away and go home. We reversed on him, followed him down, fired a heat-seeker missile, which looked like it may have hit part of his tail. We followed him down, thinking it was an old, which the North Koreans use, their MiG pilots use, a tactic to make the enemy, or in this case the Americans or the friendlies, to make the friendlies think that they were shot and that they were going down, when in point of fact they would get down and make a low pull-out and come back up. Because we had known that this was a MiG tactic that had been utilized many times in the past, we followed him down and watched his aircraft impact the side of a mountain. We therefore pulled off, started our climb out of the area. We, at this time, were coming out by ourselves. We had no wingmen. The rest of the strike group had exited 10 to 12 miles in front of us. As we were climbing out, we were passing through 17,000 feet, still looking throughout the sky for MiG-related aircraft, since we knew there were many bandits, by many I mean in excess of 15, airborne and in the vicinity. As we looked through the sky, we, perhaps due to our excited, high-key nature of this entire environment, with aircraft exploding, people in parachutes, men screaming at men to maneuver aircraft in a rather wild flail of modern-day jet fighter aviation.
Did Tun bail out?
No, he rode his aircraft into the ground, yes. Nonetheless, as we were leaving the area, we could see the ocean in front of us and knew that we had perhaps 30 miles of travel time until we got to the ocean. Passing through 17,000 feet, the enemy launched a surface-to-air missile at us, which we did not see until it detonated. What it felt like was someone taking a handful of BBs and throwing them at the side of an airplane, and the flash gave the same sensation that you would feel in the morning when you get up after a rather tiring yet refreshing night of sleep and you turn the light on for the first time with that type of flash, with a handful of BBs being thrown at the side of the airplane. It was that noise and that flash. And that's how I can liken it to. Our aircraft still continued to fly, and we felt that perhaps, although we had sustained a close call, and again the airplane jounced as if we had flown through an air pocket, which I'm sure many people have experienced when flying commercially. The aircraft still continued to fly, we continued our climb, and everything appeared normal for the next 15 seconds. Then, however, the nose pitched violently left, and as I looked back over my left shoulder, I noticed that the airplane was on fire and burning. We had several people in our flight who had seen our fireball screaming at us to eject. We, of course, had our radios burned out and were not able to receive their transmissions, although both pilot and RIO could talk to each other during this environment or during this scenario. We had always pre-planned that in the event we were hit over North Vietnam, we would not eject over hostile enemy territory unless it was a matter of complete life and death. And at this time, we felt although in extremis, we would still stay with our aircraft and continue hoping to get to the water. We control the nose, for those of an aviation background, we control the nose with the rudder, and we did not maneuver the control stick at all, or the aileron, because we were losing hydraulic fluid at a very rapid rate, and for those that drive automobiles with power steering, when low on hydraulic fluid, you notice the steering wheel growls or it's harder to turn. The same with an aircraft. You need hydraulic fluid to move a jet aircraft at those high supersonic speeds. You would never move it. It would be like a stick in a block of cement without hydraulic fluid. Therefore, realizing that any input we made to the flight control would be forcing that much more fluid out of the aircraft, we kept the stick in the neutral position and used only the rudder pedal to control the nose. We were able to get the aircraft out to a point perhaps a mile and a half on the ocean side of the North Vietnam coast. At this time...
Roughly where were you now? Walking, say Haiphong or Vinh or...
At this time we were approximately 25 miles south of Haiphong. At this time, we tried to get the nose back up one more time and carried out to get a little bit further away from the coast. However, at this point when the nose was 45 degrees nose up, it fell through and we went into an inverted spin, losing complete control of our aircraft. At this time I was told to eject by Lieutenant Cunningham, and our call between crews has always been, Willie, eject, eject, eject. I, of course, heard Willie E, and boom, I was gone. In the F-4, we had the capability of the man in the rear cockpit being able to eject the man in the front cockpit, and we had always planned to do it that way so that he could fly the airplane right up until the last second, and I would worry about ejecting the both of us, which I did. I ejected myself, and he ejected with the automatic sequencer that I fired 1 second after I ejected. And our first sensation was from an airplane that was frizzling and burning on fire, very loud and crackling noise, all of a sudden out in an extremely, deafeningly quiet world. And our separation from our ejection seat was very smooth and our parachute automatically deployed. We were at perhaps 11,000 feet when this happened. And we had at this time no sensation of falling through the air. It was something like animated suspension of sitting in a chute up there 11,000 feet, and now all of a sudden taking stock of what had happened in the past 15 minutes. The first thing we did was come up on our survival radio and advise the necessary authorities that we had been hit in our approximate position and what we were requesting in the way of rescue services. We were told that rescue services were on the way, and within 30 seconds, there were two Navy aircraft that orbited our position with a clear to fire on any hostiles who approached. Now, three North Vietnamese fishing boats and a freighter were coming toward our position. And although it appeared that we would land in the water, we were still rather concerned with the prospect of being captured by these fishing boats and freighter. We left our beepers on so that the rescue aircraft would know exactly where we were and in which direction to home in on us. Now, I've been asked repeatedly in news conferences throughout the country what was going through my mind at this time as I sat in my parachute after shooting down three MiG aircraft, after becoming the first ace of the Vietnam War, first all-missile ace, the first ace in 22 years, and then being shot down myself. I was asked the question on numerous occasions, what did I think, what was going through my mind as I sat there in my parachute and looked down at the fishing boats from North Vietnam coming to get me? And after all I experienced, what was going through my mind? Could I please relate this to the press? My answer to this question was, at that particular time, I thought I made an incorrect decision in leaving the Army Reserves back in Boston. On a more serious note, when we came down, we hit the water uneventfully. Both of us got out of our parachutes, and on the way down, we were close enough, perhaps within a half a mile of each other, so that we were able to give our friendly fighter pilot wave to each other. Upon hitting the water, again, we both got out of our parachutes, deployed our life rafts, got into our life rafts, and again, with the fishing boats still not realizing that they were dead in the water, we both of us checked our pistols to make sure that they were armed and ready for any ensuing action that may come. Since the person conducting this interview is affiliated with the Blackshear Navy, I will relate a story. A Blackshear vessel approached us, but we waved him on.
Now, what do you mean by Blackshear, Lieutenant? Or some other people listening to the tape might not know.
Actually, I'm only poking fun. On a serious note, we sat in our raft from anywhere from 15 to 18 minutes, and we saw at that time two of the most beautiful airplanes we'd ever seen, and they were Marine helicopters. Now, we in the Navy jet fighter community have had the tendency in the past to snidely snicker at helicopters, but in this particular instance, these were two of the most beautiful airplanes, again, that we had ever seen coming over the horizon. We were rescued uneventfully, all equipment, and we were, again, thoroughly trained by the Navy that here's what we should do when in this environment, and if plan A does not work, go to alternate plan B, and if this does not work, and the point being, we were thoroughly briefed, thoroughly trained, the equipment worked, the training that we had received in the past was invaluable because it cut us by, enabled us to perform our duties, although in a still extremely hypertense situation, to still calmly and very unemotionally perform our necessary tasks at hand. We were rescued and taken to the USS Okinawa for medical checkup purposes. Both Lieutenant Cunningham and I were declared sound medically and returned to our carrier, USS Constellation, later that afternoon. We arrived on board a helicopter to the cheers of the 5,000 men on the carrier Constellation when our helicopter touched down. We were taken off the carrier the following morning and returned to the United States for a hero's welcome as the first two aces of the Southeast Asian conflict. We toured the country conducting anywhere from 5 to 6 interviews, television shows, news tapings, etc. per day for the next 4 to 5 months, speaking to numerous groups and continuously emphasizing the point that at that particular time, and even now, we never felt like war heroes. We felt like two young men that were given certain talents in airplanes. We were given certain degrees of luck in being at the right place at the right time. And finally, we were given certain graces by the good Lord to perform what was a significant event in naval fighter aviation history. Nonetheless, as we toured the country, we continually tried to make the point that our experiences were not unique, that many of our peer groups could have performed the same thing if given the same set of circumstances. We were, and we felt very strongly, and I repeat this, we were not, in our own opinion, war heroes. The war heroes that we related to were the men who were confined to the prison cells in North Vietnam.